Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Selected Pros podcast. I want to give a special shout out to Teddy, Frida, and Crow Norlander for supporting the podcast via Patreon this month. I greatly appreciate it. I am giving away some books from the extremely talented painter, visual artist, and writer Dmitry Samarov. He's based in Chicago, and he's an all-around genius guy. I had the pleasure of speaking with him a week ago, and that interview will be coming to you soon. I think probably in September, because I'm in the process of planning a wedding / getting married, which I'm very excited about and busy with. Things like flowers and DJs and COVID vaccines. Well, a lot to consider. Titles available from Dmitry are Music to My Eyes, All Hack, and Soviet Stamps. I'm going to put links to each of those in the episode description. Check them out. See if there's something you might be interested in. They are like beautifully put together, interspersed with gorgeous illustrations from Dmitry, and, you know, fascinating reads. And Dmitry also provided some postcards and matchbooks with his original artwork on them, and they're also gorgeous. I do hate to part with them, but I do it for you. So to win a free book, all you got to do is tweet at me the name of the author that you would most love to see on the pod. My Twitter is at Selected Pros, very straightforward, so have at it. Lastly, I don't really like to ask for reviews on the podcast, but as it stands on Apple, I'm sitting at 29 reviews, and it's just been that way for a while. Now, I'm, believe it or not, diagnosed with OCD, and numbers really trigger me. I haven't slept. I've been drinking and engaging in risk-taking behavior. It could potentially affect my marriage. My dog isn't speaking to me anymore, and it's all because of 29 instead of 30. So if you could just leave that 30th review on Apple Podcasts, I would finally be at peace with myself and the world. Anyway, that's it for me. Let's get started. Today's guest is Andrea Bartz. She's the author of the critically acclaimed and best-selling The Lost Night and also The Herd. And most recently, her book, We Were Never Here, was released by Ballantine on August 3rd, I believe. Wonderful, suspenseful, addictive thriller. Reader's Digest calls it the best fiction book to read this year. BuzzFeed says that Andrea Bartz has proven herself a master of the timely literary thriller. I know for me personally that I enjoyed it quite a bit, and I'm especially interested in the mechanics of plot, and specifically the thriller. I've been reading some Grisham, some Charles Williford. You know, I'm always interested in figuring out new ways to entertain a reader, and Andrea does it extremely well. So we talk about the mechanics of the thriller and the this idea of like beats and beat sheets and how to make someone want to turn the next page. I saw that Ian Fleming, the James Bond guy, once said something along the lines of, the goal of a writer is to get the reader to turn one page repeatedly, something like that. But it's a simple way to put it, but it's wonderful advice for no matter what type of fiction, or for that matter, nonfiction you're writing. So enough from me. Let's get into our discussion with Andrea. Enjoy. Well, it's cool. It's so great that you could come on. I'm really excited for the release of your book. And yeah, I kind of just wanted to know a little bit about
you, I know you're like a travel writer too, and so when did you start dabbling in thriller writing?
Right. So I was actually a magazine editor before any of the full-time writing stuff. And I started working on my first thriller, The Lost Night, when I was still a full-time magazine editor. I did National Novel Writing Month, and kicked out somehow 50,000 words in a month back in 2014.
Wow.
And then at that point felt like, well, I can't stop now. I'm most of the way there. It was total sunk cost fallacy, and I was not remotely anywhere near done. That was the beginning of a multi-year process. But that idea, really none of those words, but that idea eventually became my debut, The Lost Night. Right around the same time, I started writing that in 2014. 2015 is when the magazine I was working at folded. It was the third time that a magazine I was working at
Oh,
folded.
wow. Damn.
What a wonderful and stable industry. So I, kind of redoubled my focus on finishing this book and selling it, and getting an agent and selling it. And that was also when I started freelancing full time. And initially, I was just really writing for women's magazines, doing like health and sort of mental health and sex and relationship articles. And I was traveling in all this newfound, not free time, but like flex time that I had. And finally made the connection of like, duh, I should try writing about this traveling that I am doing and enjoying. And so I sort of focused, started building up contacts in that world and doing travel writing. And then once I did sell that first book, and then I sold the next, and now I'm up to having sold 4 books, I didn't really need to keep doing the general freelancing, but the travel writing I just didn't want to let go of because it was so great, right? Kind of living the dream.
Yeah,
And
definitely.
that really only slowed down because of COVID. And now it's probably unlikely that I won't be going back to doing it the same with the same fervor I was before. I will have more, domestic life, the girlfriend moving in, all those things. But the travel writing was really actually a nice fit with novel writing, because even though most of my books have not been set in far-flung places, there's just something really sort of creatively inspiring about being new places, meeting people there, hearing about just lives being led that are very different from yours. There's a lot of sort of grist for the mill to be found in travel, I think.
Yeah, have you been to Chile where some of this book takes place?
So I had actually taken a trip to Chile with a friend who used to that I know from New York, who does live in Australia.
Did
And
she
those are
kill
where the
anyone?
similarities end. She is nothing like Kristen. Don't worry. She's my biggest supporter. I just keep being like, wait till you read it. But we did take a trip to Chile, including the Elqui Valley together. And we were there during this sort of off season, when it was really dead. And I kind of had the idea for the entire book while I was there on the spot. Which it's great when that happens. It's great when like
Yeah,
inspiration
definitely.
strikes and it actually sticks. But yeah, so that first sort of third of the book that's set in Chile was very much inspired by that trip.
Cool. I actually want to go back too to what you said about National Novel Writing Month. I've never dabbled in that, but I've heard a lot about it. What was your experience with it? Like, what is it? I mean, what do they put you on a schedule and such? And did you go to like the functions where people meet up and they're like, oh, I've got 5,000 words and stuff like that?
So I didn't actually go to any of the physical like write-ins or reduce sort of like the webinars. I'm trying to remember if they were virtual events because it's so hard to remember like life before everything was a virtual
Yeah,
event.
right.
But I had two friends who, my sister and another friend, and we all had book ideas that we had kind of been kicking around and saying we were going to write. And so one of them had the idea we should all do it and have a competition, and whoever I think it was whoever writes the most this month will be like the winner, and they'll get to be queen for a day or something.
Yeah.
And so, I think the idea, it's called National Novel Writing Month, or NaNoWriMo. A lot of people call it NaNoWriMo. And you just sign up online, it's free, and you pledge to write 50,000 words in a month. 50,000 words is ends up being about half of one of my novels. It's a short novel. It's the length of I think they use the example of The Great Gatsby.
The Great
So
Gatsby
it's
to
like the
50,000?
I think so.
Oh, wow, okay.
I could be remembering wrong, so maybe don't quote me, but like it's a
Yeah.
very slim novel. I think it's maybe technically above a novella, but like it's on the shorter end, but it works out to about 1700 words a day. So that's your goal. That's the pace that you're trying to keep. And that is difficult, but achievable. And so there's something empowering, I think, about signing up to be part of this community and like recording every day what, how much you wrote. What's terrifying is that if you miss one day, it's not like, you know, your whole goal gets sort of like that gets sort of amortized out over the next month. It's like, oh, wait, tomorrow I'm supposed to write 3,400 words and it can very quickly become insane. Overwhelming. And I think that's the problem people have with NaNoWriMo. But if you can do it and you can just use it as this excuse to get so many words on a page.
Yeah.
I think for all three of us, it ended up being really helpful. And we all kind of wound up with something that we wanted to move forward with. And I ended up not even winning. I think I wrote like 42,000 words and I already had 8K. So I called it 50K. Instead, I did NaNoWriMo, but my sister won and blew us out of the water and ended up with something like 55,000 fresh words. And yeah, there's just something mentally, like I said, sunk cost fallacy about like once you have a document of that size, you feel obligated to give it attention, even if you erroneously feel like you're further, it moves you further along in the process than you actually are.
Very I know. Yeah, one. It's so hard to like hold yourself accountable otherwise. A couple weeks ago, I interviewed Otessa Moshva, and she was like, I bought a book called The 90 Day Novel, and just like went through it like each day. And I was like, you know, it's such a simple solution for people who are like having trouble writing, but signing up for something like that or getting yourself a book like that, it's like, why wouldn't that work? You know,
right? Like we're all just playing mind games with ourselves, like. Writer's block is only as much of a thing as you let it be. And I definitely can get stuck trying to figure out what to do next, trying to figure out what the next plot point should be. But I can usually write some really bad words. And then at least there are words that hopefully can be fixed later.
You can at least feel good about yourself and like the fact that you've filled up some pages. But
I mean, I don't know that writers ever feel good about themselves or the work they did. Usually it's That's like... True. You That's know, I feel point. Like trash, but at least I put down 800 words.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it's enough to get you to continue.
Exactly. It's like levels of feeling like trash. That's like maybe what being an author is.
Yeah. You know, this is such a great time for me personally to have you on because I'm sort of like approaching the doorstep of thrillers. Like I haven't read a lot. Of course, I read like Dan Brown and stuff growing up and I was a big Tom Clancy guy or like military, you know. But I had a friend recently recommend me The Red Sparrow by Jason Matthews, which I'm excited to read. And then there's this like crime novelist who I think is passed, but his name was Charles Williford, and I've started to read him. Anyway, so it's kind of a new genre. It's like a new genre for me, and I personally like want to write in it someday. So it's cool for me to talk to you now as someone who's done it four times now, right?
This will be my third book that's coming out in August, and I'm writing the fourth now.
Cool, okay. So. Yeah, maybe we could just talk a little bit about the mechanics of like writing a thriller. Like you mentioned plot points, for example, like in your mind, like, or maybe you could take us to Chile when you realized that you had this idea, like, how does the story, that's such a general question. Let's see. You start with that idea. Like, how does it unfold from there? Like, are you somebody who like thinks linearly about a plot, or are you like, do you know that there's going to be this twist and you work backwards from that? Or kind of like, what's your process like with thrillers?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's definitely different for every author, every thriller author in particular. For me, I need to start with some kind of hook that excites me. And for my first two books, The Lost Night and The Herd, they were sort of similar because the initial hook was this sort of group of friends, this like interesting social milieu that had its own sort of close-knit, closed-door feel. So I basically like took this little social environment that I thought was interesting and like chucked a dead body into it. And that was my hook.
Nice.
So, you know, in the case of The Lost Night, it's like this 2009 deep Brooklyn, like warehouse parties, crazy scene of all these 22 to 24 year old creative young types like partying while the world burns. And the entire thing started with this idea of like, what if after one of those wild Saturday nights that like I had when I was 22, where, you know, you would lose your friends in this huge lost building and everyone would have a different adventure and there would be poetry readings and concerts and like EDM dance parties. What if after one of those nights, as everyone's waking up, bleary-eyed and hungover, there was a dead body in one of those rooms, one of the lofts. So I sort of built the idea out around that with The Herd, my second book. I think the pitch is even simpler. It's this exclusive, elite, bougie, all-female co-working space, sort of the VIP of that, the founder and her good friends. What if you made that the sort of social milieu for a disappearing person, for the CEO of that space to disappear, for this really glamorous, beautiful space to like have this dark and seedy underbelly and all these sort of unspoken, interesting dynamics. And then for my third book, the one that's coming out August 3rd, We Were Never Here, I didn't want to do another whodunit. And so instead it sort of crystallized on this trip through Chile in one moment where, as I mentioned, a friend and I went to the El Quí Valley. We went to this little town called Pisco El Quí, and it was completely dead. We didn't realize that we were going to be there when like nothing was open, nothing was going on. And so we were sort of the only tourists in town, except for one backpacker from Australia named Stephen. And we found Stephen on the first day, and the three of us were like inseparable while we were there. He was this great guy. We had tons of fun together, and you know, pretty much hung out 24/7. And he was so non-creepy and not scary and just such a great guy that we immediately had like running jokes about how this is his long con to like kill us and steal our money, or like, you know, we could immediately all be joking about that because we all clearly just really got along well. And it was one of the last nights we were sitting in our hotel suite and drinking Chilean wine because none of the bars were open. And Stephen made another joke to that effect. And I just out of nowhere kind of turned to everyone. And this is why it's scary to be friends with people like me who are thriller authors. I said, you know, Stephen, you've known us exactly as long as we've known you. I'm like, you didn't even watch me open this wine and like pour it into a glass for you. Like, what makes you so sure that you can trust us? And there's just a long silence. And finally he's like, well, like in a, you know, Australian accent, which I won't do. He's like, I guess I can't. And it was just really interesting to me that even I, who am very attuned to like the dangers and like interesting, you know, threats to violence that we experience as we go through our lives, hadn't even occurred to me that like he could be in danger and we women could be the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much instantly I had this idea of like two men traveling and they kill a backpacker and like that would start the book and everything that would spin out of that. So for me, it's having this initial hook that I get really excited about. And usually I, from the beginning, sketch out the main characters. Not literally, I don't do character sketches, but I just am getting my head wrapped around like who these people are, how they interact, you know, what they want, how their sort of values come into conflict, all this stuff that is good, you know, sort of raw material for tension and for stakes that will carry a book through, hopefully. And then I'm a more of a pantser than a plotter. I don't start with an outline. I don't know generally how the book is going to end. In the case of my whodunits, I don't necessarily know whodunit until I've actually gotten to writing that part, but I have a sense of the first few beats. And there's of course different like beat sheets that authors can use to work out sort of the emotional arc of their books. I use Save the Cat, which is actually like a screenwriting beat sheet. I really recommend Save the Cat, or it's a novel for novelists who are interested in following it. But with it, I sort of have figured out and have my head wrapped around the points, the inciting incident, the fun and games section, all the way up to the midpoint, which is usually a twist or it's something that completely changes the game. Like just at that, from that point forward, the story takes a new direction. And so I usually have a good sense of what is going to happen in the book until the midpoint. Sometimes I'm wrong. Sometimes what I thought was going to be the midpoint ends up being an inciting incident or happening sooner. But then from there on out, I am just like in open water, like paddling for my life. And that's currently where I am in my fourth book, which is the current work in progress. figuring out what the hell is supposed to happen and how I'm going to land all these planes that I flung up into the air. So it's terrifying every time. I don't know why I do this. I don't know why I can't just sit down and make an outline like normal people, which would make my life a lot easier. But yeah, it's just sort of figuring out the hook at the beginning, which tells you naturally the question that the entire book will be trying to answer. Right, which was sort of inherent in like the hooks I described to you, like, okay, well, who why is there a dead body? Who killed the dead body in the Bushwick Loft? Who, you know, what happened to the CEO who disappeared from the herd? And then like, what's going to happen? Are these two women going to get away with it? And what's going to happen to these two women who killed a backpacker? So I know what the question they need to answer. It's just a wild ride for me personally with a lot of my own like dark night of the soul moments, trying to get to a solution that feels satisfying.
Blankly staring into space when someone's trying to talk to you because you've just come up with a new thread or something.
There's definitely some of that. Like, I'll be so rude. I'll be mid-conversation and I'll be like, I'm so sorry. I need to get on my phone and it's just to open the notes app. I swear to you. And then like writing. Because if you don't write it down, you will forget. And it will be tragic the next day. So always write those things down.
Well, I think the middle part is most difficult for any writer. But I mean, I think if you did make an outline, like I've never been able to outline, and I don't really know a lot of like of my favorite writers if they use outlines either. It's got to be. Do you think if you did make one, you'd even be able to stick to it? Like, because don't things come to you as you're writing sometimes, and you're like, oh, this could be interesting.
That's the thing. I have this like, idea that like it would just become so easy and like not formulaic, but like just sitting down and I know exactly what I need to write today and like how beautiful that would be in my mind. But in reality, every time I sit down to write, I had the characters do things that I didn't expect or have situations arise that I did not expect. And that's what makes it, I think, really fun. That's what makes, you know, writing a thriller novel exciting. And sometimes you do have these like beautiful twists that come out of nowhere that feel shocking, but that also you realize your subconscious has been seeding all along. And like that's such an exciting feeling that you can feel surprised but also satisfied the way that hopefully a reader will be. And so yeah, I think even if I made an outline, I would end up scrapping it. I think, and from the plotters that I know, I have heard that that's very true. They make it because they needed a sort of a crutch. They needed a sort of, crutch is too judgmental, but like they need it to feel like they can move forward, but then they end up abandoning it and like, you know, going in new and interesting directions anyway. But yeah, I do think the most interesting twists can come out of nowhere. And I do think it's really funny when readers say, oh, I saw that twist coming from the first page, because I'm like, how? I had no idea. Like, you should plot my next book for me if you can just see these things from page one. Like,
does that ever make you afraid? Like, when you're writing a new thriller, you're like, I really hope, because I mean, you can only really be asking yourself when you're writing it, but are you ever worried that people are going to be like, oh, I know exactly how this is going to end?
It's really hard because as a thriller writer, you're playing with deception and surprise and red herrings. And, you know, for a twist to land and for an ending to feel satisfied, it needs to be seeded properly. It can't come out of nowhere. But if you seed it too hard, then it's going to be obvious. I'm very much of the belief that like if a reader figures out a big twist, like that doesn't mean that you did your job poorly. If you're doing it right, and I'm making up the statistic, but I feel like one out of every 10 readers should guess it. Also, readers are sitting there guessing every possible outcome.
Right.
So they just remember that was one of 20 things that floated through their head. Like, yeah, if there's five suspects and you at different points think it's all five, like, sorry, I'm not going to whip out a sixth out of nowhere and have it actually be them just to surprise you.
Yeah.
But, you know, more to your point, like when you are writing, you cannot be an impartial reader, right? Because you know the answer. And so it's really something I'm constantly working on, like trying to gauge my own, read over my own work and gauge what is too subtle and what is too obvious. But I can't know with complete certainty. And so that's where like beta readers and crit partners and ultimately your editor come in. But it does mean that, like, for example, I have a good friend who's one of my crit partners. We like trade our pages. She and I will sometimes like work out plot points together. We call it plot doctoring. But sometimes one of us will text the other and be like, oh my God, I just came up with the most amazing twist for Act 3. And then the other one's gonna be like, oh my God, tell me, tell me. And then about half the time we're like, actually, wait, I just want you to read it because I need to know if it works. And if you know, then you cannot have this sort of, clear, you know, objective sense of whether or not this is obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a really weird and tricky thing about writing thrillers, and especially about writing whodunits, which have such a crystal clear question and really a finite number of solutions. And, you know, I think twists should be fun for the reader, but it's not the only mark of whether or not a book is enjoyable.
Right.
Please, Goodreads users, they can say whatever. Goodreads is not for authors.
Yeah, they literally can say whatever sometimes.
No, quite literally. Yeah, it's wild. It's a wild, wild west out there.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, violent thrillers and stand-up comedy writing have a lot in common. Like seeding something properly, but still it being surprising when the punchline or the twist comes, you know?
No, it's true. That is really true. They're both playing with twists in different ways and playing with surprise, right? Like setting up expectations and then doing an interesting twist on them. That makes me think of the Hannah Gadsby stand-up special.
I haven't seen it.
Did you see that? She had one that really took off. And so then her next one had these sky-high expectations. And so she sort of made it this meta thing where she was explaining to the audience how stand-up comedy works. And she's like, okay, so I'm going to start by telling you this joke about Louis C.K. You know, it's not that great. But then I'm going to bring it up later and you're going to have forgotten it. And so then you're going to laugh hard. And then you're going to remember that I set it up that you were going to laugh a second time. So then you'll have a third level of laughing. Yeah. But she just is sort of pointing out that way that you as an author or stand-up comedian, in her case, are like playing with, you know, where you're directing the audience's attention and setting up certain expectations and then turning them on their head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is such a tough question too, and you don't really have to answer it, but I'm always curious about, in fact, I talked with Darren Strauss about this. Do you know Darren Strauss by any chance?
Not personally.
Okay, yeah, so he's like working on a thriller right now, which is exciting. And so we were talking a little bit about that and we're kind of talking about like this, the distinction that's made between, I guess, like whatever, like literary fiction and genre fiction. And first, I guess I would ask if you feel that distinction at all. And second, both him and I were kind of like, there's no reason why they can't coexist, you know, like just a really well-written thriller. And I'm just curious as a quote unquote thriller writer, what your take on that whole dilemma is.
A lot of thoughts about it. I mean, I definitely fall down on the same side as you of like, why can't something just be a well-written thrill, you know, a well-written thriller or a, you know, literary novel that has thriller elements? Like, it's so arbitrary. Like, you know, A Little Life versus Gone Girl, like they're treated as such completely different genres when, like, if you really looked at their DNA, if you show these to someone who didn't understand marketing, like, would they really think they were that different?
I don't think so.
And yeah, it's something I never thought about when I was working on my own books. And yet I got really frustrated by it when I was trying to sell The Lost Night, because editors to whom my agent had, you know, submitted it were coming back and saying like, it's like a little too literary to be a genre thriller, but it's a little bit too much of a thriller to be literary fiction. So we just don't know how we'd sell it. And I was sort of banging my head on the desk being like, why is it a problem that I write well and did a thriller? like what should I have dumbed it down more? And it actually makes me think about certain authors, and I won't name names, who write both under their own names and then use a female sounding pseudonym to write more like women's thrillers that are just sort of dumbed down. Like, they basically, many of you say, like, yeah, they're just like, you know, speedier and sappier and like less complex writing. And it's like, readers are smart, like, give them a little bit of credit, like,
right,
little lady brains can handle good writing and like nuance, sorry to tell you,
right?
So yeah, I think it's a frustrating thing. I think it's all marketing, and I think there's been, and which is good news, I think there's been a big movement in psychological thrillers, particularly led by women, I think by female authors, of like really beautifully written thrillers that people aren't scared about. Like, it's seen as a good thing that the writing is really, you know, sort of muscular and compelling prose, in addition to telling a really, you know, spinning a great yarn and telling a good story. So, you know, hopefully we can move past that. Hopefully yeah. people, if they don't like, if they just don't like the way that I write or consider it to whatever literary for their taste, there's like tons of other books out there for them. Mm-hmm. No books for everybody. But, you know, I will say this is making me remember with a shudder when that agent was on submission with The Lost Night, and I asked to see the rejections from editors, which I don't recommend. It's not fun.
No, I think I would pass. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what compelled me to want to know, but I asked to see, and so she obliged. And one of the editors who said no, you know, everyone's complimentary and likes the writing, but didn't like this, or didn't like this, but, you know, didn't like the writing, but did like this. Of course, they all have different opinions. But somebody said, you know, this just didn't work for me as a thriller, but I couldn't help thinking that this author could write a really wonderful coming of age, you know, relationship, focused millennial coming of age story.
Yeah.
And could really knock it out of the park. And I was like, but I don't want to write that. Like, I want to write thrillers. Why are you demanding I take away like the elements that make it fun for me, which is like
become John Green.
And, but yes, like, let me keep my dead bodies. Like, right. That's what I'm here to do. This is what I set out to do. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Let me do it and like write with the voice that I write with. Like, I didn't choose to have I have a pretty like flowery way of writing. And I'm aware of that, and it's just how I write. So, sorry, I wasn't setting out to do it to sound like to fit into a certain genre.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's definitely, I the cynical part of me thinks that they just have like those Hudson News book stands in mind when they're looking at this stuff, and they're like, how can we package this? And
what section would this go in? Like, we can just say it's like the new whatever. And it's like, well, what if I'm not the new anything? I'm just like,
yeah, you just had a cool idea and you turned it into
yeah
that's interesting. Exactly. So what about, I'm interested what you said about like this new wave of female thriller writers. I love like Tana French, for example. I think she's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering, as I don't know much about thrillers, can you kind of like talk about who maybe some of these people are, including yourself, obviously? But
sure, yeah, I think Tana French is a perfect example of it. She's a beautiful writer. I mean, some other ones that come to mind, and of course, after this call, I'm going to think of 10 more I should have named, but, yeah. You know, Eliza Jane Brazier, had a debut come out, If I Disappear, that was beautifully written. Megan Collins, really, really lovely, very character and relationship driven, thriller mysteries. Angie Kim wrote, a really awesome, very complex courtroom thriller. And I never thought I would love a courtroom thriller, but just beautiful writing and really centering relationships. Oh goodness, there's so many that I'm just overwhelmed and drawing a blank.
No, that's cool. I have a few to start with.
Go to those and it'll start, you know, the algorithms will start recommending more.
But yeah,
this,
right.
There really is this cool thing happening where I'm finding these female authors who just write really beautiful books that like could stand on their own in the literary section, but are also thrillers. So they're total page turners and super fun to read.
Yeah. And I, again, like that to me is more exciting than something purely literary where it's kind of like, why not tell a great story? Like Darren brought up in our past interview, it's like, that's what Shakespeare did. Like they were extremely entertaining plot wise and they were also beautifully written. And it's like that, why not? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Why can't we combine the two? Why does it need to be like, you know, quiet and a little bit less dramatic to be taken seriously? Like,
yeah. It's strange. It's strange.
Yeah. Let's let it be fun. It's a pleasure activity. Reading. Yeah. At least it's supposed to be, right?
For sure. It's a good reads activity. So you can one up each other on your.
It's true. I was thinking too, that's another way that like being a stand up comedian is like being an author, like, people who don't do it and will never do it get to decide whether or not you did a good job.
That's a great.
Like, I would have done it better. And it's like, yeah. Would you? Because have you written books? Like, tell me about those.
Yeah. Yeah. I could get up there on stage and talk about the airport. Funny. Yeah.
To be clear, I love Goodreads users. Don't.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No,
don't
me too.
Cancel me.
It's a totally great place. That's just funny. I mean, I think any author understands exactly what you're saying, or it's just like, you know. But I kind of want to talk to you too about the thriller in general. Like, where'd you start? Like, do you remember kind of like when you got into this, and do you have some influences other than the people just named, but kind of like the old school, like Agatha Christie's maybe or something? Do you have any influences in that regard?
Great question. I grew up a voracious reader. I've always loved sort of horror as a genre. I wouldn't be super surprised if at some point I didn't try to dip my toe into that.
Ooh, that'd be cool.
So growing up, it was, you know, Goosebumps and Fear Street and Lois Duncan and that whole delicious genre. And I also was reading, Nancy Drew. I was loving the Babysitter Club mystery books. I got really into Agatha Christie in probably high school, and read a bunch of those. And so it was always like part of my media diet, not exclusively, but, I loved a good tale. I loved sort of the puzzle element of it, of trying to, you know, figure out along with the protagonist what's really going on, and just sort of the page turning quality of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're driven by such a clear question that like you can't stop flipping the pages. Back in 2014, again, when I was kicking around this idea, I was trying to come up with a book. I knew I wanted to write a book. I had no idea what it is, which is sort of like knowing you want the tattoo, but you don't know where. Like, it's not really anything you can act on until you've landed on an actual idea. And it was around that time that a friend told me about Tana French, actually. And I started with the first book, and I read them all through in like a week and a half. I was just completely addicted. And it was probably actually one of the first times that I had experienced that nexus we're talking about, of like really incredible, beautiful literary writing with just truly page turning, bubblegum, like so addictive storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I finished it and I was like, I think I want to write a thriller. Like, I love that experience of reading this and being in that world. I'm like, I would love to recreate that. I want to write books that I would want to read. And I think I also incorrectly, I remember like Googling how to write a whodunit, and it is formulaic in a sense. There is this clear, I think this was before I knew anything about beat sheets and I hadn't found Save the Cat yet. But it is sort of this clear, like, you introduce the mystery, you introduce, you know, what needs to be solved and all the suspects. In that first half, you like lead towards an erroneous conclusion. And at the midpoint, either that erroneous conclusion is that suspect is cleared, or like another body shows up. Or that suspect shows up dead or something. And so I wish I had known that I was just looking at a version of a beat sheet and could do whatever I wanted, but I sort of erroneously thought this will be maybe easier than me just trying to go out and write any old kind of, you know, contemporary fiction or literary fiction or something, because there is sort of the structure to it. And then cut to like 2 years of me flashing, burning, rewriting, like getting rid of everything I've done, like creating a book that made no sense, having to sort of strip it down to its bones. So it turns out whodunits are really hard. It turns out any kind of book you write is really hard. But whodunits in particular, I think, are very tricky, because you need to be keeping up the stakes and the tension when like the killer's already killed, the dead person's already dead. And it's very hard to keep the threat and danger of the killer hanging over the protagonist when you can't say who the killer is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this unknown entity, and yet whoever's trying to figure it out, your, in my case, amateur detective, feels very personally threatened by it, and you know, feels like at any minute their own life could be in danger, even though this person is not still, this person is not in the, you know, someone you can actually shine a spotlight on. They're sort of off screen, off page. So I was wrong about the whole it'll be easier to do it thing, but I did know that I really enjoyed reading whodunits that had sort of a literary edge. And I just sought to take it on myself, and kicked off that journey of, again, the sunken cost fallacy of like, well, I'm already in this deep. Better just keep going.
Yeah, it turns out it was the right call.
Turns out, thank God, here we are.
That's interesting what you're saying too about like keeping the tension with the protagonist and doing it, because you know either it's like it becomes an obsession where for whatever personal reason like they've got to find the killer or they feel threatened like physically. But how do you come up with that? Like, is it just based on the character first? You're kind of like, because I'm thinking maybe like True Detective, right? I'm sure you've seen True Detective, right? Where it's like Matthew McConaughey's like, he's obsessed with these questions of good and evil and the Yellow King and stuff. So it's not so much that he feels personally threatened as opposed to he's kind of an obsessive character versus like, this is a killer out there and he kills amateur cops, you know, like that's being too obvious, right? You know?
Right. No, it is tricky. And I mean, I see why a lot of people like to write to set like detectives as their protagonists, because then it's the detective's job. Even Tana French with the Dublin Murder Squad books, like, the person trying to solve this mystery is a detective. Like, this mystery was handed to them by virtue of their career, right? And so she always does a really brilliant job of like somehow making it personal and like really involving like their own demons that they need to face by virtue of solving this mystery. But there's no like, you know, question that they're going to take this on, because literally their career depends on it. And I just didn't want to write a police procedural. I didn't want to know. I have no idea how to convincingly like write from the perspective of a detective. And so with my two whodunits, I knew I was going to have an amateur detective sort of personally invested and like on a mission to figure out why, to figure out that main question, the whodunit. And so, well, for the last night, I took a page out of the Girl on the Train sort of genre, amnesia thrillers, which she wasn't the first to do it. And I wasn't the first to also do it, I think. And I made it so that this character is sort of stuck in the narrator sort of stuck in the past, stuck in this era when her best friend did appear to have killed herself during a night of hard partying in the lofts. And I wanted there to be some interplay of like her questioning if she herself was involved, because she was blacking out. She has alcoholism in her own past, and you know, had a really complicated sort of frenemyship with this woman and complicated feelings about it. So for me, the ticket there was sort of figuring out like what relationship between herself and this dead woman would make it so that she was compelled to get answers and answer this question for her own sort of personal journey. And, you know, for The Herd, my second sort of whodunit, it's told from dual POVs from two sisters who are also very close friends with Eleanor, the founder of the CEO and founder of The Herd Who Goes Missing. And so they both are very close friends of hers, and they both sort of have different secrets from their own past that are wrapped up in their relationships with Eleanor, with this woman who's gone. So they have very personal reasons for wanting to find out what happened to her, and also sort of in service of keeping their own secrets safe. So I think the secret... I was just having this discussion with someone. I think the generalizable thing is that, you know, that sort of new age idea of everyone who comes into your life is a teacher and has something to teach you. And every situation that you're going through is sort of like for the benefit of your, even if it's terrible at the time, it's sort of like for the benefit of your leveling up, your evolution, your awakening. And so I think there's sort of a similar thing going on with my books where the narrators find themselves in a very, very close relationship with another woman. All of mine are sort of about female friendships. They find themselves in these really close relationships that they have to learn something from, and they have to overcome something to really level up and understand something about themselves. And because I write thrillers, that gets taken in the form of like the friendship crashes and burns. The other friend ends up dead. The other friend ends up like killing a backpacker and then looping you into helping to cover it up and flee the country. And so there's sort of like dark, twisted ways to do it. But I think to actually sort of answer your question, that my narrators, my protagonists have these compulsions to, you know, figure out whodunit or sort of see this thriller book through and accomplish whatever they need to take this reader on this journey, because their relationship with either the deceased or the missing or the sort of co-conspirator is so personal and intense, and something that they need to, you know, they need this person as a teacher, but just very dark, twisted, mm-hmm. messed up way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was sort of a rambling answer.
No, that makes total sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because it's like, I think maybe it's just people who, like you said, like people who are never going to write a thriller or do comedy or are kind of judging it. I think like me as like a consumer of that type of media, these types of things are like taken for granted, right? Like you just kind of assume that the police officer, the detective is going to have this like personal reason or whatever, but actually constructing it, I think, is way harder than like the viewer gives it credit for.
No, absolutely. It's really hard to do right. It's really hard to pull off. And it's really hard to, like, you know, create this sort of backstory and evolution that's enough to carry a story through to a satisfying conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, for me, it always just takes so much sort of character work and like relationship work and like literally with a sketchbook, like putting these two main characters on like the opposite side of a piece of paper and just writing about their conflicting values and like how they each think about each other and how they each think about things that are important to them, and like really sort of nailing to myself, feeling really clear on their relationship and how they sort of push each other to change. And then hopefully that comes up really subtly and effortlessly, mm-hmm. in an experience for the reader that like they don't even notice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the goal, for them to not even realize that they're reading. I was just talking to somebody actually about spy novels, John le Carré and stuff, and I think you'd be the perfect person to ask just in terms of writing a thriller. But what, I mean, I know it's like authors are obviously supposed to get into other people's heads and such, but is it difficult like writing a detective, for example, like without knowing, or really like you can't just like go become a detective, or like maybe you can do a ride along or something, but all you really know of is what you've kind of seen on TV or read in other books. But is it tough writing, you know, a detective or somebody with like some specialized knowledge that, do you ever feel like insecure? Like a cop would never say that or something.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's a clear reason that I do not write from the perspective of detectives myself, and instead write from the perspective of generally young women living in cities, working in creative fields.
Yeah.
no relation. But there's still like a lot of research that goes into it, and I have the utmost, I have so much respect for people who do like write these characters who have careers that are so different from theirs. And I think it does, if you're going to do it right, it does take a ton of research. And that's, you know, reading memoirs, that's doing interviews with the people who do actually do this. I'm in a Facebook group called Cops and Writers. That's just like thriller writers asking questions like, you know, where is the morgue? Like, where would somebody be asked to identify a body? Like, is that at the police precinct? Or like, you know, we don't know. Or just like, how would it happen if a missing person later became, you know, a confirmed murder victim? Like, would new detectives be assigned to it, or would it, like, God, I just have no idea.
You all probably have the most messed up Google search history.
Oh my God. There's definitely a file on me at the FBI, the CIA or something. Like, there's a lot of like, oh gosh, especially with this book, We Were Never Here, because they're the perpetrators from the beginning. Like, they kill a backpacker and then literally like dispose of his body. Yeah. And so I have so much research because the worst thing is that somebody gets turned off from the entire book because they're like, you could never dig a grave in that much time. One star, done. Like,
for sure.
You gotta get little sure things right so that time. People, I'm sure, like, you don't want people to get distracted by these sort of inconsistencies or inaccuracies. You want them to just be like in the story and buying it. And so I have so many search histories about like, how would two people carry a body? Like, is it easier to drag or to like lift? and like, would you barrel hold? Like, I was just gaming out, like, literally how to bury a dead body in like remote Andes mountains. And like, someday I'm going to get a knock on the door and I'll be like, well, that was a long time coming.
There's this suspicious van that's been parked outside of your Brooklyn apartment every day. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of it, but it's still there.
Oh, that's cool.
I think my favorite picky reader thing is a friend of mine wrote a book that the different chapters were like timestamped. It was an entire book that took place over 24 hours. It's a really great book. It's YA. It's called Love and Other Train Wrecks. A really adorable YA rom-com. But somebody took the time to cross-reference the date, the time, and when the sun would actually be up. And they complained that like, the narrator commented on it still being dark when the sun would have already been up by then. And that was why they didn't like it. And it's just like, who hurt you?
Yeah, that is so far, going so far out of your way to like find something.
Right. You took the time to look that up? Why?
That's almost more, you should be able to leave them reviews about who they are as people.
Like a lot of effort, like 2 out of 5. Like, yeah, that, job.
It's funny. I just finished a story that I was like really proud of, and I think I said the morticianer instead of the coroner in the first line or something, and someone was like, I'm like, well, what about the rest of it?
right. What about the other 99.9% of it?
No, that's cool though. So what's your do you have like a extensive research process then, or is it kind of Like how much time are you spending between researching stuff? And like, I imagine The Herd, for example, which I haven't read, but I can't wait to read, is well, first of all, how timely with like WeWork and all that stuff. But second of all, I mean, did you work in a co-working space? And maybe it starts there, but you'll obviously have to do about like a lot of research about what it's like to live the life of a CEO or something. And
yeah, so for that one, I'd gone as a guest to The Wing back in the day, which is an all-female co-working space, one of many, but like maybe one of the better known ones. Mm-hmm. And I sort of got the idea sort of grew out of that experience because I just thought it was interesting that I was going to this space that was supposed to be sort of this feminist utopia and like free from the male gaze. And yet I felt very compelled to like wear a cute outfit, like do my hair, like be very charming when I got there and like, you know, behave the way I was, that everyone else was, and really fit in amongst all of these just completely glamorous, beautiful women. I was like, my hair is definitely not shiny enough to be here. When will they notice and kick me out? And so I just thought there was a really interesting tension of like, ooh, they like want to be progressive and inclusive, but it's naturally exclusive. And like, it's, you know, free from the male gaze. And yet it feels like more, you know, sort of beautiful and glossy haired than mm-hmm. ever. And so that was why I felt like there was a lot of like great tension to play with for a thriller novel. And I also sort of intentionally didn't go back too many times because I didn't want it to be accidentally too beholden to a real space through The Wing, and I wanted to sort of have the freedom to create my own fictional co-working space. And so I did do research about, you know, I read profiles of The Wing's CEO and other sort of girl boss founders, and I really wanted to understand like what that experience was like and what tightrope they were walking of needing to have sort of feminism as part of their brand and part of the company's ethos, but then like running into all of these blocks of like, well, wait, they're still like putting the company first, or their, you know, employees are putting bottom line first, and their employees are accusing them of being mean, which is something we never complain about with male CEOs. And like, there was just a lot of interesting stuff that came up in articles that was like good fodder. I would say that the research that I do is much more practical and much more boring. And it's really like flying by the seat of my pants. As I'm writing, I'm like opening up another tab to, you know, look up how long it would actually take to drive from, you know, Las Vegas to Arizona, right, so that right. I can get that right. And like, you know, at the end of a writing session, I'll have like 20 teeny tiny tabs. And as I'm going through and closing them, it's sort of like this walk back through like, oh, I looked up like, you know, the name of a like good DSLR camera. And like, oh, I look at just all of these little, and then there's the wild card of like carrying a body, like temperature at Juliet night, like just all of these different things. So I would say most of it is by the seat of my pants, and some of it is like bigger things that I know I'll need, I'll look up beforehand to really like get a sense of a place or get a sense of a career that's not mine. Like what kind of stuff would the narrator of We Were Never Here, the project manager at a startup. And so I wanted to just sort of understand that role more. And I'll be doing that beforehand, or some days maybe I'll be doing that in lieu of a writing session. And that's a really good, like if you're just really tired or sick or hungover and you're like, I cannot put words on the page today. It can still feel like, okay, I'm at least making progress in some background way by either returning or getting ahead on these things that like, I know maybe in the manuscript I just wrote, come back to this, add in whatever. And it's like, okay, I can actually go do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I know it's good. I think it's probably good not to get hung up on like researching everything all the time and kind of let yourself go.
It's true. It can be a really easy way to procrastinate and I can't continue this line until I have the correct name of whatever. And it's like, you just don't want to write.
Where is this camera manufactured and what year?
I have to get this totally right on the first draft, even though I will inevitably cut that entire paragraph later. Like, no.
Yeah. Well, excuse me if I am ignorant to this, but do you have any plans to adapt any of these into movies? If they haven't been so already?
So I've been very fortunate to have all three of my books at different times optioned for TV or movies. Unfortunately, most of them have not announced deals, and so I can't say much about them.
Okay.
And I am not really involved in any of them. I have sort of like contributing producer titles and stuff like that like may or may not actually have teeth. But it's been really interesting. Like I have talked to different production companies, and had really the very interesting experience of like hearing Hollywood brains reflect back to me, like how they would see these stories working on screen, which is really different. And I'm just very conscientious of the fact that like, I know books and like they know movies, and like, it would be a big mistake for me to try to take the movie in my head when I write these books and just like word for word, scene by scene, moment by moment, try to put it on screen. Like it wouldn't work. And I'm very aware of that. So I'm very respectful of what they bring to the table. But it is really interesting. Like to me, you know, kind of the keys that I'm always looking for is like these deeper themes and like these female friendships and like female shame. And in the case of We Were Never Here, I was talking about you know, violence against women and how women are always thought of as sort of the, you know, the receivers, the victims of violence instead of ever the perpetrators. And like this is the stuff that's really interesting and exciting to me. And that is just not what comes out on these calls, because they're thinking like visually, like we're gonna, you know, there's such a great friendship to show on the screen. And like, this has like beautiful backdrops and lots of tension and twists, and like they're just seeing it in such a different way that it's always a little, it's exciting and also a little like, oh, okay, baby, like there it goes.
Yeah.
Like, it's like watching this like precious thing sort of float off into its own future. And that's Hollywood, and that is not what I do. Yeah. I mean, I do someday have interest in, I would love to adapt something, but yeah, so far I've been like leaving it to the grown-ups.
Yeah, for sure. I know. I always just think about the difference between like scenes in the writer's head versus scenes on screen, and you know, you don't have a lot of control over it. But yeah, it's probably tough to send it off. It's like sending it to a distant boarding school or something, and it's formative years.
Yeah, and you're like, all right, I have to just trust that I like made the right call with, you know, handing you over to the right headmasters or whatever, and like, have a good year. I'll see you in summer.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. I feel like I learned a ton about thriller writing, and I kind of want to start one, you know?
I think you should. I think that's the thing that makes me the happiest to hear, is that when I like really nerd out and get excited about thriller writing, when somebody says it makes them want to write a thriller, I'm like, do it. It's so fun.
Yeah.
It's awful because you're sitting and you're trying to write and that's awful, but it's so fun.
I think I am personally, and a lot of people who listen to the podcast are at the point where they know that they like want to write a book, but maybe haven't yet. And it's cool to just see how excited you are about it. And it's also great, like how well received We Were Never Here is so far.
But yeah, people seem to really be liking it, which is a huge relief, because you write a book and you just have no idea.
Like, hey, Oprah liked it.
That's true. I mean, oh. I can't, when Oprah Daily is saying nice things, like, I have nothing but excitement. So
there you go.
I'm so stoked for it to come out. I'm so stoked for people to read it. I'm so stoked for, like, the haters on Goodreads to tell me why it's so terrible and how unlikable these women are. I'm actually kind of excited for that, because all of my books, there's some people who just say the characters are so unlikable. One woman asked me why I wrote my characters so from a book club, asked why I made my characters so unlovable, like not even worthy of human love. But in this book, it literally says on the jacket that they kill a man in like the first few chapters. So like, yeah, these are not little angels. And if that's what you're looking for, like there's tons of other good books,
yeah,
in other parts of the bookstore or library, and you should go read those.
I'm always blown away by that criticism. Like, some of the most interesting characters in all of literature are unlikable. I don't understand what you want your main character to be like. A perfect.
Yeah, I really think, like, if you want some little perfect, happy, cheerful, helpful, quiet, subservient woman, like, she's not going to make a very interesting thriller novel.
Not at all.
It's not going to be fun to follow her. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, yeah. Weird. Well, you can just ignore them, you know, whatever. What do they know? But
it's just, you know what? It's still exciting. People are reading it.
Like, yeah, definitely.
It's way
definitely.
Better. It's way better to have haters and people who love it and people with different opinions than to only have it read by like your parents and two friends. So
right.
Can't complain.
All right. Well, people love it and it's great. And yeah, so I think I'm really excited for it to come out too and to release this episode. I have to wait a little bit to release it, so I'll do that.
Yes, thanks for rolling with that. Really appreciate it. And yeah, this is just like super fun chatting about all things thriller. And yeah, I really appreciate all your great questions, and I hope you do write a thriller and that I can say something mean about it on Goodreads.
Nice on the jacket, mean on Goodreads. How about that?
That's okay. Deal. All right. I'll do it.
Good deal. All right. Well, hey, good luck with the move and everything. And
thank you so much.
Please keep in touch, and I'll let you know, or I'll let I guess Sarah know, you know, when everything's coming out. And hope to talk to you again soon. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks, and keep in touch.
All right, will do.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, everybody, thank you for tuning in. Andrea Bartz, We Were Never Here. Buy it. Let me know what you think about it. Please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. Join Patreon if you're so inclined. Find me on Twitter at Selected Prose, where we talk about stuff like books and the lit world and my various illnesses and all sorts of other things. So. Yep, next interview will be with Dmitry Samarov. That'll be coming out again at some point. You know, I don't know when, but stay tuned and talk to you soon.